Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 9. But be aware, we're going to quite often have parallels from the Chronicles now. So 1 Chronicles chapter 19, verse 10 starts telling the exact same story. We are probably in David's very last part of the first half of his reign. What I mean by that is probably 18th or so year, 18th or 19th year of his kingdom. And he's quickly approaching his 50th year. Now, why is that important? Because the events we're looking at right now are leading up to his grievous sin with Bathsheba, which really causes trouble, just kind of radiates trouble for the second half of his kingdom. I believe that we can kind of backdate from the birth of Solomon to this event. And so I put this event right around 998 going into 997 BC. And it starts when the king of Ammon, a man by the name of Nahash, dies. Now, whether this is Nahash who caused trouble at the beginning of King Saul's reign, or whether it's his son Nahash, ultimately it doesn't really matter to us, other than curiosity's sake. David clearly became friendly, shall we say, with Nahash, the king of the Ammonites. The Ammonites were paying tribute to King David's kingdom. When this Nahash dies, though, David sends some of his men, some of his ambassadors, to send condolences to the new king and to pretty much establish the continuance of this relationship. Unfortunately, this new king listens to some of his advisors and purposefully insults David's ambassadors, cuts off half their beards, cuts off a portion of the backside of their clothing, and shames them. And so David declares war on the Ammonites, and he sends his army under the command of Joab and Abishai across the Jordan, through Gilead, and up against the capital city, Ammon. We have Ammon, Jordan today, which is pretty much the same place. And so now we're ready for the battle. 2 Samuel 10:9. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him both in front and in the rear, because he discovers once he gets there that the Ammonites have hired Syrians to come down out of the Baca Valley and beyond to join in defending Ammon and the Ammonites against the expected invasion of King David's forces. Remember that David, earlier on in his kingdom, had taken over that entire Baca Valley and had made it part of his tributary, filling out the fullness of the promised land. So these guys apparently saw a possibility here to join forces with the Ammonites and throw off the shackles of the Davidic kingdom. And so Joab's got himself caught between the city of Ammon and the Aramean or Syrian forces that have come to reinforce it. So verse number 9 continues. He chose some of the best men of Israel. He arrayed them against the Syrians. So he sends some of his best people to take care of those coming from behind him. The rest of his men he put in charge of Abishai, his brother. he arrayed them against the Ammonites, so on his front toward the city. Then he said to Abishai, his brother, and remember, these two men are David's nephews, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come and help you." Very sound tactical arrangements. They're basically going to go back to back as units. And if one side needs assistance, then some of the other forces will shear off and go and reinforce that side. Then he said this, verse 12, "Be of good courage. Let us be courageous for our people," that's for the Israelis, "for the cities of our God," that's the promised land itself, "and may he who is do what seems good to him. And may God like sort it out." Now, of course, he's hoping and praying that it will sort out for the Israelis. Verse 13, "So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him." So Joab's forces, very strong on the attack, and he breaks the Syrian front that's coming from behind his forces that are camped against the capital city of Ammon. When the Ammonites saw that the Syrians had fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. Now, this is clearly talking about the forces in front of the city itself, the defensive forces to keep them away from the walls. Once they realize that their allies have run away, they figure they're in trouble because now they're going to have the full force of the Israeli army against them. So they run back into the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. Because now it's going to turn into a siege situation. So he's going to go back and talk with David about the situation. And then it's just a matter of starving the people out. That's the way sieges worked. You cut the people inside the city off from all supply routes and waited for them to get hungry and thirsty and willing to make a deal. And make no bones about it, David's intention would be to bring these people back under his tributary control. He doesn't want to annihilate them. He doesn't want to wipe them out. He would much rather that they surrender, and he can probably put more compliant people into positions of leadership within this community. But look what happens in verse 15. "When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel," so the retreating Syrian forces from up in the Baca Valley and beyond, "they gathered themselves together." So they rallied their remaining forces. Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. Now, Hadadezer is the guy that we read earlier that David had defeated and apparently put under tribute. Well, all of that's out the window now. And so Hadadezer, who has already gotten himself in trouble with David for making this arrangement with the Ammonites, he decides he has nothing to lose to try it some more. So he reaches beyond the Euphrates to more Arameans or Syrians, people that are related ethnically, and reinforce his troops. So he brought the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam, which we don't know exactly where that's at, but it appears to be somewhere in the north, somewhere probably in that Baca Valley region. It's a mustering point. It's a bivouacking point for these Syrian forces to get ready to march down to Ammon, or against Israel proper. So they came to Helam with Shobak, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, at their head. When it was told David, he gathered all Israel together, crossed the Jordan, and came to Helam. All right, I have to correct myself already. I somehow missed remembering that one little line there when I was doing my research about Helam, and I trusted too much in other people's information. If David crossed the Jordan, it means Helam has to be on the east side of the Jordan Valley, probably up toward Damascus, because the way that forces from the Baca Valley, from Aram beyond the Euphrates River, they would come down past Damascus and down the what's called the Royal Road or the King's Highway on the east side of the Sea of Galilee and then the east side of the Upper Jordan until they finally arrive at Ammon. So we'll do a little flying correction here. So Helam must be somewhere east or northeast from the Sea of Galilee. And so that's where David intercepts them. The Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him, which his whole point is to stop them from reinforcing the Ammonites, who were under siege. The Syrians, again, fled before Israel. So they were broken again because David has the entirety of the Israeli army and the militia of Israel out against them. Plus, I think we should also note God's assistance behind him. So when they fled before Israel, David ends up killing of the Syrians. Now this is the numbers from 2 Samuel, 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen. The numbers in 1 Chronicles, you can find it in 1 Chronicles 19, 18, are 7,000 chariots and 40,000 foot soldiers. I actually think the Chronicles number is probably the more accurate. Remember that hand copying the scripture from its original through multiple manuscript copies, two of the hardest things to hand copy with great precision are proper names, proper nouns, and numbers. And so this is where we sometimes get textual variants, and then we have to make a judgment call as to which one is more likely to represent the original inspired text. And so my feeling is, if you've got 40,000 foot soldiers, more than likely you're going to have a very large number of chariots. 7,000 seems reasonable to me. But he gets rid of them all. The 2 Samuel passage says he wounded Shobek, the commander of their army, so that he died there. So he inflicts a mortal wound on the commander of these forces. So once again, the Syrian forces have been broken by the Israeli forces. Verse 19, when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites any more. And so we end up with a peace arrangement. And the Syrian forces come back under Davidic tribute. And it would also include some people that weren't originally under that, coming under tribute to King David. Now, there are some people that wonder, and I have been in this camp, whether or not this is actually a description of what David, what we've already seen reported, how David brought the Syrians underneath his control. And I suppose it's possible But my thinking at the present time is, as I'm presenting right now, that these guys actually saw the Ammonite rebellion against David after the death of their king as an opportunity to throw off their own tributary status. And it would appear that it backfired, and they ended up coming under his tribute after the loss of a whole bunch of soldiers and equipment. And the tribute was probably going to be even more the next time around. So more than likely, in my estimation, that all took place in 998-97 BC. The next story is the pivot story. It is the very important background to David's grievous sin. And so I believe this happened in the year that started in 997 BC in the fall, and this is happening in the spring of 996 BC. It's the second year of Israel's campaign against the city of Ammon and against the Ammonites for their rebellion against their tribute to King David. So here's what we read, 2 Samuel 11:1. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. One of the reasons that our month March is named March is because it's connected to the god of war, Mars. Because wars often resumed or got kicked off in the spring of the year. Because the winter months were over, the cold, the wet, the snow was finished. And so that's why it mentions it here. So more than likely, we're talking about right after Passover in this particular year. So David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. So he sends the large portion of the Israeli army across the Jordan again, over to the capital city of Ammon to continue the siege. Now, there was already a force that stayed there. This is to really press it. And so they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. So Rabbah is where Ammon, Jordan, is located today. But David remained at Jerusalem. Now, by my estimation, this is happening probably the 19th or 20th year of his kingdom, which means that he is turning 50 right about now. And so what we actually see here is a little bit of what we would refer to as a midlife crisis. We are told that it happened late one afternoon. Now remember, afternoon is from the midpoint where the sun is 45 degrees down toward the west, down toward the setting sun, and sunset itself. We would shortcut it as something like 3 p.m. until about 6 o'clock. So David arose from his couch, and he was walking on the roof of the king's house. We believe, many of us, that King David's palace that was gifted to him by the Sidonians, by the Phoenicians, is built on the north end of the city of David, which in modern location, this is a couple of hundred yards south of the Temple Mount, several hundred yards south of the Temple Mount. It would have been the highest point in that walled city of Jerusalem at that time. And particularly on the east side, going down into the Kidron Valley, it's very steep. It drops off really fast. And so there are houses built kind of stair-stepping on top of each other. That's the way that it would have been designed. So from his rooftop, which he's using as his patio, his porch, the place where he can kind of take in the cool air of the declining day and just kind of relax, his roof overlooks all of their houses in the city of Jerusalem. And so he sees from that roof a woman bathing. Now, does that mean she's like in a tub? Not likely. More than likely, she's not even naked. I'm thinking that she might, in fact, be washing her legs and her arms, and David sees her in a way that is not normally publicly seen. The culture of the Middle East has very often had this idea of women keeping their legs and their arms covered. And so that which is covered is often very alluring when it's uncovered. And so David sees her in this way, and the text tells us that the woman was very beautiful. She was attractive in a way that David instantly takes note of in his looking at her. And so he then makes his fateful choice. Now, this is where we have to be honest in our evaluation of David. David started out a very good man, a man after God's own heart. He did great things, became king, but not very long after that, he started adding wives into his household. And we know very specifically that that was against the rules. Moses passed on God's word very clearly on that point. Whenever there was a king in Israel, eventually, he was not to multiply to himself horses or chariots or wives. But we know that David has been adding wives to his family. Now, the reason the kings did wives back in that time was to make deals, to make treaties, to make arrangements with other people. And so David has been using that Middle Eastern manner of increasing his kingly power. And in this moment of time, he looks at this woman and feels that he would like to have a relationship with her. And so he inquired, he sent and he inquired about the woman, because he didn't recognize her. And someone told him, is not this Bathsheba, or possibly Bathsheba, because that's how her name shows up in 1 Chronicles, the daughter of Eliam, or I think Hillel might be, or something like that. Let me see if I can check it here real quick. Amiel, as a possible other name for this man. But she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, who is Uriah the Hittite? Well, when you go to the passages that annotate the 30 of David's army. And this is talking about the commanders and the sub-commanders inside David's army. You have several that are at the head of the 30, and so they don't count in the number of 30. But if you go down the list, and the list is found both in 2 Samuel 23 and 1 Chronicles chapter 11, you eventually get down to the very bottom of the list of the 30, and you find the name of Uriah the Hittite. So he is in David's army. He is one of the sub-commanders inside of David's army. But he is down at the very bottom of that list. And I'm going to be honest with you, I think it highly unlikely that David had anything but passing interaction with Uriah up to this time. That he probably allowed him to be promoted to this position within the 30, the sub-commanders, but he would have done that on the advice of his top commanders. And so David does not likely have a personal relationship with this man, and he certainly doesn't know his wife until this moment. Now, Uriah is also non-Israeli. He's a Hittite. He's from the sons of Heth. But he has clearly come to be part of the Israeli community. And I have every belief that he was a believer in the one true God. So, after finding out that she's actually the wife of one of his sub-commanders who's off at war, verse 4, David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now, she certainly would have been under pressure because of an older man, a king, inviting her to come over. But I think there's also indication elsewhere in Scripture that she was complicit in this as well. This is an affair. And so when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, meaning they had sexual relations, she went back home to her house.